Well, you know, occasionally on Fresh Air, I invite people with interesting collections to join me on the studio and share some of their records, usually 78s. That's how I first found out about the Burke family, who are my guests in the studio now. They have a great record collection, a collection of compositions by Joe Burke, who happens to be the father of my guest, James Burke, and the grandfather of my guest, Linda Burke. James Burke is an MD, a general practitioner, who practices in Philadelphia, and Linda is a photographer who studied here at the Moore College of Art. We're going to be hearing Joe Burke compositions sung by people like Billie Holiday, Frank Sinatra, Nat King Cole, and more. Some of his more famous compositions are Tiptoe Through the Tulips, For You, Carolina Moon. He did a lot of collaborating with people like Al Dubin and Edgar Leslie. Joe Burke, by the way, lived from 1883 to 1950 and lived in Philadelphia. He began composing in about 1911 and just continued composing through the years. Welcome to both of you. It's a great pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you, Terry. It's nice to be here and nice to have my father remembered.
I'd like to ask you how close you were with your father.
Well, I was the youngest. There were three of us together. And my memories were all well-cherished, and I was really devoted to my father. Number one, I always liked music, but I never played anything. And he was, of course, quite a pianist. He was taught the conservatory music when he was a tiny boy because he was the baby of his family. And he learned music early, and he married early, and he had to work in orchestras at night to make a living. And that's when he conceived the idea of writing songs. And so it used to fascinate me and all our family that my father could sit down and play and then somebody could bring home a record with my father's name on it. It was such a great satisfaction. I really worshipped him as a hero worshiper.
Linda, your grandfather passed away when you were young, when you were about four. Do you have many memories of him?
I don't have too many, although I've heard of him my whole life, and I also have a tremendous admiration for him. But the only thing I can remember is he used to put me on his knee and say to me, "Linda Pinder, look out the window." So it's a little brief.
You know, like when kids are growing up and they're in school, everyone talks about what their parents do. And, you know, like my father works at a factory, or my father's a doctor, or my mother does this, my mother does that. When you used to tell the kids that your father was a songwriter, what kind of response did that get?
Mostly that? Laughter.
What kind of laughter?
Well, they would... No, it was not a sneer, but it was like, what does that do for? It doesn't do anything. Because in those days, when I was in grammar school and my father was really working at night playing in orchestras, so it would have been better to say he worked or played in orchestras at night to make a living, and that was, they related to that much better than say he was a songwriter, because they would think of Sousa or somebody like that, you know, as writing songs and marches and things of that nature. Band music.
It doesn't really seem like a legal profession.
It didn't seem like anything real to them. But to say that he played the piano and he played in orchestras, that meant something, and that was more impressive than to say he was a songwriter. And then, of course, when I got to high school and college, when all the fellows and we were interested in records and recordings and orchestras, then it started to make an impression. So I became more of an attraction through my father at that time than I ever was before.
Linda, what kind of response did you get about your grandfather when you were a little older and referred to him, say, when you were in your young teens, for instance? Because he wrote a kind of music that I imagine when you were in junior high or high school was not very well known to your peers.
Most of them didn't know any of the songs that I mentioned. It wasn't until Tiny Tim came along and did Tiptoe Through the Tulips that everyone would recognize it right away and be very excited about it. If they believed me, they were excited, but I didn't get much response. It was more from my friend's parents. If I spoke to them, then they would be excited, or if they went home and mentioned it to their parents, then they would come back and say, "Oh, my mother knew who you are," and all that, things like that.
So the kids didn't believe you?
Most of the time they didn't, when I was younger. The older I got, the more they started to believe.
Well, let's listen to another song that was written by Joe Burke, and this time we get to hear Frank Sinatra singing "Oh, How I Miss You Tonight." Do you want to say a few words about this recording?
Well, that was written in 1924, and it had great difficulty. Dad had a great difficulty in getting it published. Not many people thought it was meant very much. So he got a singer, Mark Fisher, to record it, and for that he was given the privilege of getting part of the royalties. And as soon as he recorded it, it became a hit. and it remained a hit, well, ever since 1924. Of course, lately it hasn't been recorded so much, but all the big singers of the day in the past 50s and 60s have made records of it. And we love it, and we think it's easy to sing, too.
When I was traveling in Jordan, I heard this come over some kind of muzak or whatever that they had there, which I thought was really fascinating to hear it that far away.
Really? Okay, yeah. Well, let's hear it. This is Frank Sinatra singing Oh, How I Miss You Tonight, written by Joe Berg.
Oh, how I miss you tonight. Miss you while lights are low. Oh, how I need you tonight, more than you'll
Frank Sinatra sang Oh, How I Miss You Tonight, which was written by Joe Berk, and Joe Berk's son James Berk and his granddaughter Linda Berk are in the studio with me now. We're going to be listening to some more of the recordings that he wrote throughout this discussion. I remember when I was growing up, like around the dinner table, for at least the first half of dinner, a lot of the conversation, particularly on bad days, would be about the problems my father had at work that day. And I don't know if it was like that for most other families, but James Berk, I imagine that your father at dinner would talk some about the work that he was involved with. What were some of the nature of some of those conversations?
Well, he was always striving for a hit. And as I said, he used to play as a young boy, and he used to have these old albums of Strauss's and Waltz's and Bach's, and he used to play around with those trying to get tunes, and he'd ask us whether we thought that this little melody would be something, But then, of course, at that stage in my life, I was more interested in Tom Swift and football and whatnot, and I'd say, oh, yeah, Dad, that was the extent of it. But my brother, who died when he was quite young, was a musician, and he played in orchestras, and he used to give him real good criticism. And, of course, my sister, Teresa, she plays and plays the piano well, and she also has written a few things herself. And she used to give good criticism. Even my mother played, and she used to. But we always would know that Dad wanted us to say, that sounds great, so we would learn that early. And, of course, he was always afraid that he would never make it for this and never make it for that. And some of the things that he loved dearly, thought would be very great hits, were flopoldas, as we used to call them. And some things that he didn't care much for, he just wrote in an hour or so, they turned out to be hits. So he said you can never predict anything.
Were you ever able to predict?
No, I loved to. No, I loved mostly the things that were not hits. Oh, I did love For You, I guess, because I don't think anybody could dislike that song. And but there are certain things like that he wrote that looks like Rain in Cherry Blossom Lane was a hit, and yet I didn't really particularly like that song.
We've all seen those movies about the song composers who write three fantastic, brilliant lines and then get blocked and they can't come up with the rest of the tune. And they spend half the movie in torment. And in the finale, closing scene, the line comes to them and love enters their life and everything's wonderful and the movie ends. Was there anything ever approximating that?
Most of the time, like for instance, when he went to Hollywood in 1929, they would just say, we have a score here, we're going to do this musical, and I want you to have it by Friday. And that's to have it 14 songs. And this would, this was not the way it was done in New York at all. But they managed to survive. If you really have to produce, you produce. You just dig. And Al Dubin was a great idea man, and he would be able to break up the tensions lots of times. Because my dad was a plugger more than like I am, and he would keep working, but Dubin would put a little humor into the situation, and that would get by. And that's when they did some of their greatest work. The Gold Diggers of Broadway was a great success, the first musical comedy in movies. So it's all a question of applying yourself. But with the ones he really loved to do, he'd love to have been in show business because he thought that was the greatest things like that. Richard Rodgers and Ron Berg and Jerome Kern, and he always loved to get. So the closest thing he ever got to that was doing a movie and he did quite a successful show out of Gold Diggers of Broadway. It was great music.
That's certainly true. Let's listen to another of his recordings. We're going to hear Yearning as recorded by Tommy Dorsey. What are your memories of this?
Well, Tommy, I never met him. Of course, Dad knew them all. And he was famous for the swing arrangements. Originally, Yearning was written as like a ballad, sung like a ballad. But he put the swing arrangement and made it quite a difference in the tune, and I like it very much better. Yearning was written about the same time as Oh, How I Miss You Tonight.
Okay, let's hear it.
That's all I do, my dear.
All love will come back to me.
Learning why I'm blue, I wish that you were near.
Send the mantle over you.
Smiles have turned to tears.
Now I feel well done.
Days have
All I'm asking for is one more
journey.
How'd you like it?
Just for you.
Love is just around the corner.
I hope you're yearning to.
I'm in the mood for love.
Joe Burke's song Yearning, as recorded by Tommy Dorsey. Again, joining me is some of the Burke family. I'm in the studio with Linda Burke, who was the granddaughter of Joe Burke, and James Burke, who was the son of Joe Burke. We're talking about Joe Burke and his music, which we're also listening to. Can you tell us a little bit about how Joe Burke sold his songs, what that process was like?
Well, mainly, he would get an idea for a title, and he would develop a tune around that, usually by just walking at night, whistling. He used to do a lot of that. And then when he'd have a song, he'd have his friends, that, like Al Dubin was in Philadelphia too, or Benny Davis, who was a performer, and they would give him, they'd get together and they'd get a lyric. Then the big job was to try and make it simple, because in their early days, the way that little kids growing up were taught to play the piano, and you couldn't have them play Rhapsody in Blue, so you'd have to have something very simple. So the tunes were simple, so it was easy to play, and then therefore being easy to sell sheet music, because in those days, the sheet music was the way of making a living. Then, of course, records came in at that time, too, even before that, but records were not the great seller that sheet music was. So they would try to go to, usually to Philadelphia outlets of major publishing firms, and try to sell their song. And if they would like it, they would do it. And it took a lot of finagling. They used to try to get bonuses or advances so that the publishers would have to then work on their song, because naturally they were convinced that they were going to be hits. The publisher wasn't so convinced. So if you got an advance, that means at least they'd put their pluggers to work so that the song has a chance. But eventually you had to go to New York if you really wanted to get anywhere, because that's where the main bases for all the publishing houses were. Was in Feist had outlets in Philadelphia, Remick had outlets, Whitmark, but they were just second rate. And they'd have to go to New York with your song, show it to the big bosses. And so that's why Dad eventually wound up in New York during the week and home on weekends.
How come you all didn't move to New York?
Because he was a dyed-in-the-wool Philadelphian, I guess. His family were here. As they say, there were three of us. And my mother was a homebody. Great. She really raised us, because Dad was out working all the time. And so she loved her home and her sisters and her family and everything. So that's the reason we stayed.
Did it bother you that your father was, you know, in New York so much of the time, and, you know, busy with his music so much of the time?
Well, I think that it bothered me that if I had a problem, what I thought was big, you know, that I think my father would answer better than my mother. But I soon learned that my mother knew darn near everything there is to know, and she was very good that way. Wonderful, wonderful woman.
Okay, well, let's hear another recording. Now, this is one I've never heard of before. It's called Baby Your Mother, and we're going to hear Don Bester's recording of it. You want to tell me about it?
Baby Your Mother was originally written, again, as a ballad. And, of course, it was quite popular in the late 20s, and it was one of the things that gave Dad his impetus to get out to California. And, of course, when Don Bester recorded this, he changed it around, just like Tommy Dorsey changed Yearning around, and I think it improved the song tremendously. It was a great hit in the 20s, but like so many others of all songwriters, including my father's, nothing ever happens after their first hit stage.
Okay, well, let's hear it. This is called Baby Your Mother. It's a recording featuring Don Bester. Another tune with music by Joe Burke. You had been saying that when he was writing, what would frequently come to him first would be the title for a song, which really surprises me given that he was the music writer and not the lyricist. It's funny he should be thinking about titles.
Well, titles sold a song very often, and maybe it wasn't his idea. Maybe it was somebody's idea, or an ad in the trolley cars, where every trolley went, the trolley car that he would see that would catch it and make the, gee, that'd be nice to get a tune. And then he would go around. He always used to whistle when he was walking out. He loved to take walks up and down the street. And so that's, he really didn't need the piano to work, except maybe to work out the chords or something or other. But he'd get he'd have a title and try to get a tune to fit it, and then it would work up from there.
There's a lot of titles of his songs that are like place titles, you know, like My Rose of Waikiki and When It's Moonlight in Brooklyn. There's a couple of Moon Over Miami. There's a couple of other Honolulu tunes. Did he travel a lot, or was just imagination?
He traveled. He loved Miami, and that's where that Moon Over Miami came. In fact, he was called the Moon King because he had written Carolina Moon and the Valley of the Moon, and then he wrote Moon Over Miami. So the moon, he went by train, of course, in those days, and the story that he told me is that he would get out and walk up and down the platform as the train would stop on the way down, and he was impressed because the further south he got, the bigger that moon seemed to grow. And so he had to write a moon song about Miami, so he got his friend Edgar Leslie, who was a dyed-in-the-wool boy from Brooklyn, who never wanted to leave New York. There was no place in the world. There wasn't even any sense in going to New Jersey. That's right. He gave him the title, let's write a song, Moon Over Miami. So Dad wrote the tune, and Edgar filled in the lyrics, and there it was. But Carolina Moon, I don't know how that came about, but I guess he was always astronomically minded, I guess you'd call it.
Do you remember anything about When It's Moonlight in Brooklyn, which he wrote with Al Dubin?
No, that was a comedy thing with Al Dubin, because Al Dubin was a fun guy, and anytime he came into your house, you were bound to laugh, and I could just see them saying, well, that's a great tune, Joe. Well, that's that's the way that would develop.
Who were his favorite collaborators? Who did he like working with the most?
I think he liked Al Dubin best of all. He was a fly-by-night in the sense that he wasn't too reliable, but he was really brilliant. And some of the, like, Tiptoe Through the Tulips. Now, Out of the Blue come that way. Or Painting the Clouds with Sunshine. And, of course, he wrote with other men like Lullaby of Broadway and 42nd Street. He always had great ideas. Dancing with Tears in My Eyes with my dad, that's a great idea. Kiss Waltz. They were wonderful. So now Edgar Leslie was a great writer, and I always admired his work tremendously, but the thought guy in my book was Al Dubin.
Well, let's hear another one of the Joe Burke Moon songs, and we'll hear Carolina Moon. Who was the collaborator with
that? That was Benny Davis, who was a performer, vaudeville team performer originally.
We're going to hear Tommy Dorsey's band performing this.
Perform that. And Benny Davis also wrote Margie, but not with my father.
Okay. Well, let's hear Carolina Moon.
Thank you.
Okay, that was Carolina Moon with Tommy Dorsey's band. If you're just joining us, we're listening now to music that was written by Joe Burke. And in the studio with me are two of the members of the Burke family. Linda Burke, whose grandfather was Joe Burke, and James Burke, whose father was Joe Burke. James Burke is an MD, general practitioner, and Linda is a photographer. We had been talking a little before about Tiptoe Through the Tulips, which is probably the most famous, I think, or the most well-known, anyways, of Joe Burke's songs, in part because every generation knows it, because it was recorded again by Tiny Tim in the 1960s, I guess it was. What do you remember about the writing of this song, which was written for the film Gold Diggers of Broadway?
Well, when that was the first show that he did when he went to California, and he was amazed that they gave him this, said, look, we want a score of 8 or 10 songs by Friday. And of course, they didn't work like that ever. So they worked very hard, and finally, with Dubin's great ideas, came up with such a title as Tiptoe Through the Tulips, which was just the name itself would strike your fancy, let alone the tune, you see. So they worked hard on that, and Nick Lucas made a beautiful recording of it, sung in that day. It seems a little funny now when you hear it today, but in that day it was well done and was quite successful. And, you know, everybody, after the success of Gold Diggers of Broadway, all the studios made recordings of, made movies of musical comedies, so much so that they became a dredge on the market, and the business flopped. So there was great sadness in Hollywood, and of course Dubin said to my dad, he says, look, Joe, he says, don't worry. He said, with our size, my father being about 5 by 3.5 and Dubin 5 by 6, he said, if we could always do the tour of vaudeville, and he said they'd have this beautiful scene on the stage of all these tulips, and then we too could just tiptoe through these little tulips. And he said the people would laugh for 5 minutes, and the program was only for 10, so he said it would be a great success. But that was a hard show for them to write, and they did it, and they did it well. But they did a few more, but they didn't last well. And so Dad came back to New York after that, and Dubin stayed out to write scenarios, potentially, but then another fellow came out, and he did very well with another man.
When Tiny Tim was cutting his recording of it, did you know that that was in the works?
No. No, I never heard of Tiny Tim until I heard him do Tiptoes of the Tulips on Johnny Carson show one night, I think it was. So, and then when he came to Philadelphia, through Reggie Doherty, a friend of ours from golf, was a manager of Sears Roebuck in Philadelphia, the Eastern Division. So he said Tiny Tim was going up to give a audition, or no, give a performance.
Autograph.
Date up at Sears. He says, you come up here. So I went up to him, and I met them for the first time, and I couldn't get over it. But he said he knew all these songs. He knew Baby Your Mother that I spoke of earlier. He knew that, and he knew the words, so he knew that Bell Baker made the original recording of it. I said, well, that would be a great song for you, but I think there was somebody wanted a little bit of change passed by.
What were your impressions of him?
Well, I think he's just a little odd fellow, that's all.
Uh-huh. Linda, what are your memories of Tiptoe Through the Tulips, which is, you described before that as being the song that everyone in your school knew existed, that your father, your grandfather wrote?
Well, I always liked it, and once Tiny Tim made it popular, that was when my friends knew about it. But before that, I still don't know that many of my friends knew. One time when I was in high school, we were studying about Holland, and I, of course, told my teachers that my grandfather wrote the song Tiptoe Through the Tulips, and they were thrilled, so they set up a whole scene for us to do things with windmills and tulips, and I, being the star, had to tiptoe through the tulips. So then my friends remembered it. From then on, I was famous.
Great moments in high school history. Mm-hmm. I bet lots of people who are listening now had similar high school performances, probably with Tiptoe Through the Tulips in it. Did you get a lot of money when Tiny Tim's song got royalties?
Yes, we had a good revival, yes. Mostly, not so much on his recordings. People did. Our money really comes through performances through ASCAP now, because record sales are more for the younger group buying younger singers' recordings, and our record revenue comes mainly from albums of like Al Martino and Frank Sinatra, and where you don't get the same rate that you get on a single record, but at least it keeps your portfolio a little active. But most of our money comes from radio and TV.
Mm-hmm.
And so, what can I say? I don't know.
Keep on playing those records.
Yes. Keep that.
Sometimes when they
The slogan, you know, the slogan is the old songs are the gold songs.
Right.
And of course, our performances, thanks to my dear father, are pretty good after he's gone now to 28 years. And so I'm very grateful for that. They're not as great as they used to be, but Tiny Tim gave us a little boost on the ASCAP, but not so much on the records.
Okay, well, we're going to hear a recording of Tiptoe Through the Tulips. Now, this is the Nick Lucas recording, which is the original big hit.
That's right.
Okay, let's hear it.
Shades of night are creeping, willow trees are weeping, old folks and babies are sleeping. Silver stars are gleaming, all alone I'm scheming, scheming to get you out here, my dear. Come tiptoe to the window, by the window, that is where I'll be. Come tiptoe through the tulips with me. Tiptoe from your pillow to the shadow of a willow tree, and tiptoe through the tulips with me. Knee-deep in flowers bestray, we'll keep the showers away. And if I kiss you in the garden, in the moonlight, will you pardon me? Come tiptoe through the tulips with me. If I kiss you in the garden, in the moonlight, will you pardon me? Come tiptoe through the tulips with me. Tiptoe through the tulips with me.
Do you remember what year that was recorded in?
1929.
Okay.
Very well.
Did your father know? Did you think that this was going to be a big hit, that this was one of the ones that was going to really take off?
Well, I think so, because they had the first one, and they knew that that just being the first would make it attractive, and they had a great sense of songwriting ability, and they worked so hard that I think they were pretty confident that it would work out.
How about this next one, which was another Joe Burke, Al Dubin collaboration? It's For You, which is also one of the, very famous ones.
It's my favorite. It's really a standard. It's background music for lots of shows, and it has a great melody and a tremendous lyric. And it was one, Kenny Sargent made it famous in that Casaloma Orchestra, and that's the ones that my friends remember. Actually, For You, I would say, money-wise, if you look at songs that way, it was the greatest producer. Because it's every year. Moon Over Miami or Tiptoe has cyclical characters, but For You is a pretty much standard all the time. Steady, steady, steady.
Still standard now?
Oh, yes, yes.
Okay, let's hear this, the hit recording, the Casaloma Orchestra recording.
Good.
Of For You.
I will gather stars out of the blue for you, for you. I'll make a string of pearls out of the dew for you. All over the highway and over the street, carpets of clover I lay at your feet. Oh, there's nothing in this world I wouldn't do for you.
Kenny Sargent sang with the Casaloma Orchestra on that recording of For You. I've never heard that recording of it before. I'm very familiar with the song.
Well, that was the original biggie. And, of course, all our famous singers today have recorded it one time or another.
Interesting combination of things on that recording, because it's a very, very slow, very nostalgic arrangement, but there's that novelty aspect that enters through the falsetto,
yeah.
That kind of wobbly falsetto that he puts in.
Well, the Dorsey put a jazz arrangement of the same song, and it can be changed, made slow to ballad or jazzed up as any way to sell. Even though Howling Mission Tonight was done, Les Brown and his band of renown did a jazz arrangement of Oh, How I Miss You Tonight. And it sounded good.
Did your father ever work with any of the arrangers with Dorsey, for instance, and, discuss possibilities for the song? Was he ever consulted? Was he ever aware of what was happening before he heard a recording of it?
Not that I recall. Most of the time his songs were popular, and then Dorsey's arranger would work on the song, and then he would copyright his own arrangement of that particular song. And in other words, if a copyright on your song comes up for renewal, not only will your copyright come up as the writer or the lyricist, but also the arranger of a certain song would come up for copyright renewal of his arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't much that way. And maybe he did it, but not to my, my sister Teresa may know that, but I don't know any way that that was done.
How anxious was he to hear recordings of his work as they came out?
Oh, he was thrilled, I think. He used to try, because he knew Bing Crosby, being out in, they used to go to mass together, and Bing used to sing in the choir, and he used to say to Dad, he said, Joe, let me know anything you do, and I'll record it, and he really did. Anything that Dad had that was anyway popular, Crosby recorded it.
Was, like, your house the first house in the neighborhood to have a copy of a new Joe Burke song when it came out?
Oh, well, he used to buy, you know, maybe, he would, first they would give him, later on they got demos from all, and then he would get them for nothing. But in the old days, there were not many demos, so he would buy 5 or 6 records, one for his mother and one for his sister and one for our house and one for mother's sisters and all that jazz. It would cost him a lot, but of course he was very proud of his song, and it was recorded on Decca, was a recording on RCA or Victor record, and it would cost, you know, if Decca and Columbia and Brunswick and RCA would all make a record of different recording artists, it ran into a little bit of change, so he used to arrange to get them as demos later on, but not in the early days.
Well, let's listen to another Joe Burke Al Dubin collaboration, this one called Dancing with Tears in My Eyes, another really famous compositions of his. Do you want to tell us a little bit about this one?
I don't know much about that, except that as I mentioned before, the musicals kind of failed. And For You and Dancing with Tears in My Eyes and even Kiss Waltz were products of after the failure of this only proves my dad's worth, in my humble opinion, that they recorded these songs. There was no movie to put them in, and so they just promoted it like they would an ordinary song, like Carolina Moon had been recorded many years, performed or published or plugged or whatever you want to call it before. And that's the only thing I recall about it, that they wrote this together for no particular reason except that they liked the title and the melody.
How did they get the title? It's a great title.
Well, I keep talking about Dubin. I think his ideas were great. It was probably his idea, his title.
Okay, let's hear it.
Thank you.
Dancing with Tears in My Eyes, with music by Joe Burke and lyrics by Al Dubin. If you're just joining us, we're listening to music written by Joe Burke, and I'm joined by two members of the Burke family, Linda Burke, whose grandfather was Joe Burke, and James Burke, whose father was Joe Burke. The next song that we're going to hear is another one of the Moon songs. You were talking about how Joe Burke had become known as the Moon. The Moon Man. This is Moon Over Miami, another well-known one. What can you tell us about this?
Well, Dad used to go to Miami, and he loved the South, and Miami Beach in particular, and he used to go by train, and he would stand on the platforms walking up and down, and he loved to walk, and he would be impressed by this tremendous moon every time he went south. So he said to his friend Edgar Leslie, who was his collaborator at that time, he says, "We got to do a song about that moon in Miami." So he said, "Let's work up." So I said, "I have that title, Moon Over Miami, sounds good to me." So he said, "Edgar, I'll get a tune and I'll send up the manuscript," because Edgar, he liked to stay in Manhattan. He didn't like to move anywhere. So he wrote the melody, sent the manuscript up to Leslie up in Manhattan. He wrote the lyric, and from there it was no problem getting that.
There were the publishers.
No problem getting that published at all. So that from there, it went on. It became popular. In fact, Dad got the key to the city of Miami for the song. So, and that's the day. That's when they used to call him the Moon King, because he had written Valley of the Moon too, and that was popular. So, that's the story of Moon Over Miami.
Okay, well, let's hear it as recorded by Vaughn Monroe.
Moon over Miami, shine on my love and me, so we can stroll beside the roll of the rolling sea. A dream or two that may come true when the tide comes in. Hark to the song of the smiling troubadours. Hark to the throbbing guitar. Hear how the waves offer thunderous applause after each song to the stars. Miami, you know we're waiting for a little love, a little kiss on Miami
Moon Over Miami with music by Joe Burke, lyrics by Edgar Leslie. You were telling me that your father at one point had, what, four out of the first five songs on the hit parade on the radio?
Yes. After he left Hollywood, we mentioned before, he came back and he was very anxious to work, and he got a new collaborator, Edgar Leslie, who was a man who wouldn't go out of Manhattan, as I mentioned before. So they wrote many, many songs together, and in the year 1934 and 35, for several weeks, he had four out of the first five songs on the hit parade. The songs being On Treasure Island, A Little Bit Independent, In a Little Gypsy Tea Room, and a song called Cling to Me. The other song that was not his in that group was Red Sails in the Sunset, which is still popular today.
That's right.
And that went for several weeks. Now, that was their song that they had together right before Moon Over Miami.
Well, the next song we're going to hear is one of the few in which Joe Burke had no collaborator. He wrote the words and the music. And this is called Just a Sailor's Sweetheart. You want to tell us about it?
It was really written as a lark. My dad was, I guess some of Dubin rubbed off on him, and he liked a good time. And he used to play for his friends in orchestras just for laughs, because this is an early song. So he said, I'll show them. I'll write a song all by myself. So he wrote this song. There's a comedy song.
Okay, well, let's hear it. And, Gene, I don't recall who's performing this version of it.
I think it was Allen. Rosalie Allen, I think it is.
Okay, let's hear it.
I am just a sailor's sweetheart, and I love my sailor lad. But he left me broke in Norfolk. He was all I ever had. But I still believe in sailors, and I'm true to the red, white, and blue. And although I'm barred from the Navy Yard, oh, I love my sailor lad positively. I was just a sailor's sweetheart, and I loved my sailor lad. But one day at Coney Island, boy, he sure did get me mad when he put his bathing suit on, big as life tattoo there on his chest. Was the name Marie? My name's Rosalie. Did he have to take it off positively?
Tell me, was that a big hit?
It was a hit back in 1924, 25, yes.
You said the Navy asked to record it.
Well, during the war, to keep the sailors entertained on shipboard, they had natural recorders. And they made an album of Navy songs, and they asked Dad if they could use his tune and melody, or the words and music, without paying royalties. And of course he said certainly. So during World War II, it was played on many a ship, I should imagine, because it was part of a large album.
I mean, it wasn't like the you know, American Naval Chorus singing that.
I really don't know. I know it's in the band of the album that it, but I don't know who recorded it. I think it was just a naval group.
Well, the next recording we're going to hear is by one of my very favorite singers, Billie Holiday. And this is another collaboration that Joe Burke did with Edgar Leslie, Getting Some Fun Out of Life. Do you remember much about this song?
Billie Holiday really made it whatever we got from the song. It was during the Depression, and I don't really much recall much about the song.
She does a wonderful job, though, with it. It seems to really suit her personality, I think.
It's been said that a lot of times people didn't like it. Well, you know, publishers didn't like it for Billie Holiday to record a song because she would sing it so differently than it was written. She would sing it, you know, in her own style and, like, bend notes and change notes so that it was difficult to sell sheet music or anything, you know, after she got through with the song because it was not quite the way it was written. Well, let's hear Billie Holiday's recording of Getting Some Fun Out of Life.